everybody. This is Trevin McGee with the Scene Stealers podcast, and I'm here once again with my friends Eric Moline and Trey Hawk.
Yay!
Hey.
How are you guys doing?
I'm good. It's nice to be in the same room with you instead of on the phone.
What are you talking about? We're always in the same room when podcast.
Sorry.
We never do that remotely.
Sorry.
That'd be lazy. We've got two movies to talk about today. We're going to talk about Zero Dark Thirty, the latest from Catherine Bigelow and writer Mark Boll. And then we've got Gangster Squad, the newest film from Ruben Fleischer of Zombieland fame. And we're going to kick it off with one thing.
Yeah, one thing.
Us. So
okay,
go ahead,
so
Eric.
Let me
What's
go first since
thing?
This was my stupid idea. So as you're listening to this, it is after the Oscar nominations have come out. And my one thing, my prediction, my horrible thing that I'm really worried about happening is that Ben Affleck is going to get nominated for Best Director. And that's going to really suck because it's going to take somebody who's really deserving, like David O. Russell, Michael Haneke.
It's not going to take David O. Russell out of it.
He's out. He didn't get a DGA nomination. Yeah, so it's bad. I predict that Argo also might win Best Picture at the Critics' Choice Awards, which has already also happened. So these predictions you will know by now, and I think this whole Argo thing is going to throw a really serious monkey wrench into the serious. It's going to be like the crash of the Oscar season. That's my prediction. Anyway, yeah. So my one thing I wanted to talk about is this great TV show called The Joe Schmo Show.
Oh, yeah, on Spike?
It's on Spike. Yeah. It was on – was it on Spike before or FX?
Yeah,
or
yeah, it was on Spike. It's always been on Spike.
Twice.
Okay. Yeah, it's always been on Spike.
And season one was amazing because basically it's a spoof of reality shows with a script and actors and an entire crew of people except for one person who actually thinks that they're on this reality show. And they did it 7 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
And this is where Kristen Wiig came from. Kristen Wiig was on this show, and then she got on Saturday Night Live. And yeah. I remember her on that show and thinking, this broad is hilarious. And that show was really creative. And
Eric refers to women a lot of the times broads. In 1950s slang. Yeah. So it's
that
just,
dame is hot.
Yeah, yeah.
These
that dame
skirts
is,
are really funny.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, but the funny thing is in 7 years or however long it's been, someone can look it up and prove me wrong. Reality TV hasn't changed. It's gotten worse. So
it's gotten way worse. You know, I've been watching this is my one thing. I've been watching this great little show on Hulu called Misfits.
Uh-huh.
And the lead-in ads, Hulu only has like three ads. And one of the lead-in ads is Michael from The Wire.
Yeah.
Omar, the actor, Michael from The Wire, talking about marriage equality. Then the other ad immediately follows it every time is Snooki and JWoww.
Yeah.
Which she has her own reality show just about being a mom and getting alcohol strips to test her breast milk.
And they just started an MTV show that is like the sequel to Jersey Shore. It's like the redneck version.
Yeah, in West Virginia.
Buck Wild.
Yeah.
So the Joe Schmo Show, it premiered the other night. I watched, they had the first two episodes. They've got a really decent guy again, and I love how they couch it in. Oh, we just wanted to give this guy his own show. But really, they're seeing how far they can push it. Before this guy realizes what's up. And it so far, after two episodes, it doesn't quite have the newness of the first season, but it's still really fun, and I'm enjoying it. Season two, by the way, didn't work out because the person guessed halfway through the show that it was a setup, and they tried to replace that person with someone else, and that didn't work. And so season two was a wash. But, anyway, the Joe Schmo Show is on, and I'm excited. It was Justified premiered the same night, and I watched Joe Schmo instead. So that's how excited I was for it.
Nice.
You didn't miss. It was nice to be back in.
Yeah, it's going to be building, I'm sure.
It was nice to be back in Harlan County, but there's some things that were kind of weird. Patton Oswalt, especially.
Yeah.
It's kind of a broad,
I heard about that.
Immediate character. Anyway.
I'll watch that later. So.
Trey, what's your one thing?
You know, my one thing is probably not as current or as topical, but one of the things that I have done is I've gone back and really kind of explored Mario Bava, and it's something that I think that people should do. We've been seeing a lot of style-driven films recently, and Mario Bava is kind of the one that built the idea of style-driven horror films that are, you know, at the same time sort of graphically violent at times, but when you watch them, they don't hold a candle to the level of violence that we get to nowadays.
Is he before, or I know he's at the same time as Argento, but is it like he's both the same?
He's in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And in fact, most of his stuff, the height of his career is in the 60s and even to some extent early 70s.
And what are the most popular titles that people might know?
Kill Baby Kill, Hatchet for a Honeymoon. I mean, these are kind of early Chop House films, but they also have the feel of British Hammer films. He's an Italian director.
Are they in color?
Yeah, they're in color, and in fact, they're in these crazy colors. A lot of times, he's using color to motivate the psychology of the moments. Mm-hmm. So he's using lots of deep blacks and then high contrast lighting. He's using blues and reds to kind of motivate what the different moments mean.
Would you start?
I watched Kill Baby Kill. Most of these are streaming on Netflix.
Yeah, I was going to ask how to find them.
So you can kind of just start.
You kids and your internet connections.
It's a brave new world.
Yeah. But it just kind of blows my mind because I'm not a huge horror fan, and I think that these are so style-driven that even if you're not a horror fan, you can kind of just get into the style and the look of it.
Is it more psychological horror, or is it definitely gore?
To some extent, and there you've got to,
I know you're not a big fan of the gotchas.
Right, so. No, there are almost no gotchas. It's all about the sort of plotting and the characters.
Okay.
But they're really, really fascinating. And they also have that level of sort of Hammer film production design cheesiness.
Cool.
So you have to kind of accept that.
Yeah.
Also, this is not, a perfectly realistic depiction of anything. But there's something really fun about them. And you can really see how this is the forebear of a lot of 80s horror, a lot of 70s and 80s horror. So, and really fun.
Sweet. Yeah. Cool.
And what's your Oscar prediction to be proven wrong?
I'll
let you think on that.
Yeah.
Okay. we're just getting out of the holiday season, and that means time off and vacation, working from home, and all that kind of stuff. And I always use that time to kind of discover either a TV show that I haven't had time, that too. But I use that to either discover a TV show that I haven't really given the time of day, or have kind of been neglectful of, or I just kind of play catch up. Or if there's nothing I can find, I'll revisit an old show. Rewatch Deadwood or something like that. This year, I did kind of two really starkly different shows. I really got into ABC's Happy Endings. I think it's a fantastic little sitcom that really plays with the 30-minute sort of, box-style sitcom. A couple of the producers from Community started it and worked on it, and it's got just a great sort of ensemble cast. Damon Wayans Jr. is in it, I really enjoyed that and got a lot of good value out of that show. It's on Hulu only online. You can get the most recent season online, but the first two seasons are priced at, like, you can get them both for $26 together on Amazon, so that's a pretty good deal. The other show is this kind of weird BBC show that Hulu has exclusive rights to here called Misfits. And Misfits, kind of hit or miss. It's very prolific considering it only came out in 2009, but I think they're on season 5 at this point. And the whole premise is it's about 5 juvenile delinquents in England that during a round of public service there's this crazy storm that imbues not just them but people all over London with superpowers. But they're not the kind of superpowers like flight or super strength, or they're not what you'd call like A-list superpowers. They're all kind of weird and
like they grow double locks and start a punk rock band.
Right? Yeah, they're all kind of useless.
Isn't it based on the original series Misfits of Science?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I think so.
Okay,
I think that's where it comes from.
But it's the thing that really strikes me about it is one, they've got this actor. In the first few seasons, named Robert Sheehan, and he plays this kid named Nathan. And I don't know what the direction was for him, but they just let him go. They just let him everyone in the cast is shameless, and has no problem doing really explicit things. It's a very explicit television show, and that's actually fascinating to me because
you mean like boobies or what?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's sexually explicit, but what's interesting about it is that it's people in like during that age being that. Kind of figuring things out for themselves as they go. I mean, they're young adults. They're, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old.
So it's like Fast Times crossed with...
A little bit, you know. Marvel. Yeah, a little bit. There's this girl who can't, after the thing, she can't touch people because it, like, it just awakens their id and they say filthy things to her about, like, what they want to do and everything. And she has a history.
That sounds pretty good.
She's got a history of abuse, so she takes comfort in men. There's this whole thing that they kind of dig into. And so she exploits it at times. At other times, like, it's hard for her to not be around people. She doesn't want to be around people.
But have a sense of humor?
Yeah. Okay. It's got a really dark sense of humor to it.
So it's not like Twilight?
No, not at all. It's about as fucking far from Twilight as possible. Chronicle's a better comparison because it does deal with sort of that, you know, like having a hard time growing up, teen angst, a lot of that kind of thing. Also, it's just kind of funny that they all have powers, but none of them are that very, you know, none of them that useful. One girl can hear thoughts, but that's kind of pointless. She doesn't really have anything to do with it. One kid eventually gets immortality, and that's kind of awesome. But even that, you know, like it hurts. So he's not a big fan of like busting it out when he has to because, you know,
it's painful. Still,
yeah.
Right.
You know, unless you're getting...
He won't die, but he'll get hurt.
The way he figures it out is he dies and he gets buried and then he wakes up in his coffin and he's in the coffin for 2 or 3 weeks and then someone finally digs him up and he gets out and he's like, I'm great. I'm going to go tell my mom. Oh, but I shit myself, by the way. That's me, if you smell that. I was actually kind of in the middle of something when you guys got me out. So I'm going to finish. But, you know, so it's really irreverent. It's that same Sheehan character, or the guy that plays Nathan.
It sounds fun.
It is a fun show. It goes a little long. Seasons are only 6-7 episodes. After about 3 seasons, I was hoping that it was going to build into something, and it really never does. And so once I hit that point where I was like, oh, they're not really going to go any further with this. It's just going to be these guys. I really did lose interest. And then also they do this thing where they gave everybody new powers. I think they were kind of running out of steam. They switched up the cast, and then they gave the existing cast members entirely new powers. And
we do 24 shows in America, and the Brits do 6, and they run out of ideas.
Well, I think what they do is they do 6 shows to keep it tight, to keep it interesting.
They have a set endpoint, and that's so much easier to write to. And this is one of those shows where it feels like they didn't. You know what I mean? I think they started out, and I think they had an idea because there's some good sort of like foreshadowing that goes on. There's one kid who can see – he can kind of rewind the past and change things. And there's an episode where they all drop ecstasy, and it inverts their powers. So, like, the immortal kid, like, he can see the dead instead of dying himself. He can see dead people.
So it's like the Buffy episode where they have Halloween costumes.
The time guy, instead of rewinding time, can, like, see into the future and becomes kind of clairvoyant while he's tripping. And and it sets up a whole bunch of stuff, like, down the road. And you're like, what the hell? Like, this just got, like, into the world serious. And then they never really capitalize on it. So, I don't know. It's definitely a hit or miss show, but I mean, it's free. It's on Hulu. It's worth checking out.
Cool.
Awesome. I've got my Oscar prediction.
What is it?
All right. Except for screenplay and maybe cinematography for one of these films, I think that The Master, Silver Linings Playbook, and Beasts of the Southern Wild will all be snubbed across the board.
Wow.
Performances even?
I think Bradley Cooper and
possibly,
Jennifer Lawrence are
possibly
in.
Possibly Jennifer Lawrence would
she's
exception.
Her and Jessica Chastain are in the lead to win.
Yeah. That's a possible exception, but I think beyond Jennifer Lawrence and maybe cinematography or screenplay, I think they're going to get
I would be worried about The Master and Beasts, but I'm not worried about Silver Linings.
Yeah.
Well, if I have to throw a prediction, and I think that I think it's going to come down to a two-person or a two-film race for Best Picture between Les Mis and goddammit.
Lincoln?
No, I don't think it's going to be Lincoln. I think it's going to be Argo and Les Mis.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's Zero Dark Thirty and Lincoln, and Argo is the spoiler. I think Les Mis is going to fall away.
I don't know. Les Mis is like such a perfect Oscar.
But there's tons of
bait.
Of
I mean, I'm
backlash.
Thinking from the Academy, though. Yeah. Critics, whatever. But the Academy, you look at it's a huge musical. It's a story that everybody loves. Everybody that's voting, you know, every theater nerd in the world adores that story, regardless of how good or bad the movie is.
I feel like there are lots of theater nerds who actually backlash against it because of the singing. They were just like, Hooper. Hey, if they were going to have him sing on camera,
all right.
I
just remember how pleasant the King's Speech was, and how that was easy. Yeah, like,
no, Hooper got a DGA nod. He's one of the reasons Russell and everybody else got.
I don't know. I think we might be surprised because like a similar thing kind of happened last year, where it was sort of a bigger kind of crowd pleaser ended up walking away with more than we thought it was going to. So we've talked about that enough. Let's go ahead and talk about the movies. Let's talk about the movies for this week. We've got Zero Dark Thirty and Gangster Squad, and I am really excited to talk about both these. So. Let's go ahead and start with Zero Dark Thirty. It is the latest from director Kathryn Bigelow of The Hurt Locker and Point Break fame. I'll get to that in a second, but there's been some talk. Also, writer Mark Boal, real quick, he also wrote The Hurt Locker. Oscar winner, yeah. And interesting story about this. The movie was originally kind of in pre-production, and the script that he had in place was about them losing Osama bin Laden.
In the caves. Yeah.
And then they got him.
Yeah.
And so he basically had to do a page one rewrite and work this all. Like, he talked to – I just watched The Hollywood Reporter. That if you guys are movie nerds like us – go to the Hollywood Reporter website, find the uncensored roundtable interviews. They've got one for the writers, the producers, directors, actors, actresses. And then if you're into the Emmys, they've also got them for dramatic and comedic on television. Totally worth your time. They're about an hour. They're uncensored. They're hilarious. They're really candid. And you get some really cool little behind-the-scenes stuff, like the producers, when they let it slip that the town that they set up for Django Unchained was supposed to have snow in it in Montana. Tarantino had scouted it and everything. 3 months into their winter, no snow, so they had to move the entire town, pushed everything back. Another great little factoid, Peter Krause once shit himself on stage and had to finish. He was doing summer stock and shit himself in a barn and had to finish the rest of it. So that came up during the Dramatic Actors Roundtable. There's good stuff. There's a lot of good stuff. There's a really great candid conversation about gender and the questions that are asked during the actresses' roundtable. Totally worth your time. That probably should have been my one thing, frankly. But this movie, he had to do – I got that information from these Hollywood Reporter things. Mark Boal had to do a page one rewrite to make this happen. Talked to Kathryn Bigelow, and she said, I want to make this movie, but we've got to make this movie now. We can't make that one. And so – going into this film, I mean, they have the sort of Hurt Locker behind them. That sort of sets some expectations. You also have critics and, you know, detractors that are concerned, you know, is it too soon? Should we make this movie? What's this movie going to be? Worst case scenario, you're thinking it's going to be some sort of, like, jingoistic, flag-waving History Channel reenactment. And thankfully, that couldn't be further from what this movie is. Like, we've released our best of list. Mine goes up next week. This is my favorite movie from 2012 by far. I think it's the best for several reasons. But mostly, I think the biggest reason I think it's the best is because of the story and how delicately and how maturely all of the elements of this story are handled and put together. The fact that it isn't a huge jingoistic, you know, flag-waving movie really speaks to Boal's ability, in my opinion. And I think that Jessica Chastain's performance is totally worth the attention she's been getting. It's a little big for me at times, but it's because she's sort of the entire movie is on her shoulders, essentially. And she represents more than just a character. I mean, I see the film as an arc where the way that it opens and how compelled I was. I know you had to watch it at home on a screener, Eric, but in a theater in surround sound, when they layer 911 calls in.
I have surround sound.
Yeah, you're right. It's the same.
No, yeah.
The film opens in stark black, and it layers in 911
actual
911 calls from 9/11,
yeah,
and it uses a surround sound and it just stacks these calls,
brutal.
And you get this panic and this fear. And I mean, I get chills just thinking about it.
Yeah.
But when you're in a dark theater and all you can do is look at this 30-foot screen, it's really
sets the tone.
Moving.
Yeah.
And so the film starts with 9/11 and it ends with the raid.
And it ends with a certain amount of just like soul crushing revelation on this woman. And the main difference between this and another historical movie that came out this year, Argo, which I hate to keep fucking pounding this movie.
You're beating on Argo.
But here's the deal. Argo, you get out of it, and it's like, oh, that was fun. It was we went through the whole thing, and it was tense, and then it had a really happy ending. And
you get like a we did it. We did it feeling. There's even like a presentation at the end. There's even an award ceremony.
Yeah, and you get an award ceremony, and you get this feeling like Hollywood made a difference. At the end of Zero Dark Thirty, the only thing that remains are questions.
Yeah, now
and
what?
That is why this movie is so powerful.
What next? Now what?
It's just insane. It's so much.
I think it treats the subject matter so maturely that it doesn't answer those questions. That it asks more questions than it answers, and then it leaves you without a nice little bow to put on it.
Right.
That is why this movie is powerful, is that it's not afraid to let things be. And I use this term loosely because movies by their very nature are not real.
Right.
But it handles all of the aspects of this story maturely and with as much sort of reality as possible. It doesn't make us look good or bad.
Right.
It doesn't make any of the ass.
I wouldn't agree with that.
Well, I mean,
I think it makes when both. It, when makes it, us look both.
Right. Yeah. But that's the thing. That's what I'm saying is that
you're
the
saying there's
that
not
we're
one
supposed,
opinion that's being shoved
absolutely.
Down our throat,
it's not like rah rah us. It's not oh hey let's condemn us.
Yeah.
It's these things were done. Some were probably done ethically. Some were not done ethically.
Yeah.
But we are neither fully good, fully bad. Nor is anyone that we're in opposition to that also. Everybody is working for or against each other.
Okay.
And that's the way it is.
So,
and so it's very even-handed some way.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. How do you guys feel? The my main problem with the film right now is that I feel that it has come to define this narrative because it happened so quickly, because it's out so quickly after Osama bin Laden was killed, that I'm worried that this movie is going to define that narrative.
Like, this is the real thing.
Like, this is it, right? And now we know that the CIA has come out, the Senate committee has come out and said, you know, we didn't the torture that we did was supervised and whatnot, and everything was by the books and blah, blah, blah.
The torture
they don't call it torture.
Enhanced interrogation.
But they're saying that, you know, and then other CIA people are saying, and by the way, these were done in medical facilities. Everything was – there were medical people on hand. There was never somebody just, you know, saying, oh, we're going to do this, and oh, we're going to throw this guy on a waterboard and grab this and do this. And they're saying the depictions are all wrong. And then Mark Bull is coming out and saying, well, I'm not going to reveal all of my sources, but, you know, these are from firsthand accounts.
Right.
Yeah. So there's that weird push and pull where he's trying to say, this is a piece of journalistic work that I'm standing by. And then the people who are actually involved are trying to say it's not accurate. So.
And I think you need to be, with any film like this, I think you, to some extent, need to be skeptical of both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a piece of journalistic work.
I would agree with that.
It's a
I don't
film
either.
That, yeah. by its very nature, necessitates embellishment to convey the emotional and psychological.
At the end of the day, it's a dramatization.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It also is difficult to take, you know, to take at its face value reports given by organizations that by their very nature have to protect our political interests.
They're going to in some way benefit from or...
So I think that you have to be skeptical of both sides. It probably wasn't to the extent that Mark Bull's script says on any number of issues throughout the script. It probably wasn't. We were probably not Boy Scouts throughout the interrogations and the questioning and all of that also.
And so if that is represented in any way, shape, or form in the movie, then it got the spirit of that that part of this story correct.
Sure.
Is what
you're
saying.
And the reason why I say that is because, you know, the U.S. Operatives were neither fully good nor fully bad. No one was evil. No one was utterly ugly. There were things that were done that were condemnable. Mm-hmm. That those things were no longer were neither fully condemned or glorified. And
in
so
this movie.
In this
right.
film.
Yep.
And so because of it, I think that you can, to some extent, you know, as long as you're an intelligent viewer, I think that you can take what was done as having the right feel to
yeah.
it.
It's mature and thought-provoking as it could be, honestly.
Yeah.
There's a movie called Paradise Lost, the documentary, the first documentary about the West Memphis Three, and I watched it, and I was blown away with it, mm-hmm. and then I loaned it to a friend, and she watched it and called me up when it was over, and she said, oh, my God, that movie was insane. Can you believe how guilty those kids were?
Yeah.
And I was like, did we see the same film? I think that's possible here at Zero
yeah,
Dark
yeah,
30.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like there have been some – I know John McCain's been outspoken about the depiction of torture in this movie, not the same way the CIA has been, but just saying that it paints torture or interrogation techniques in a positive light, that we got valuable information from that when in reality we never got truly useful information from enhanced interrogation. I think that misses the mark, at least in the film's case. You know, if you want to get technical, they don't really get anything good from enhanced interrogation. They get good things from what happens afterwards, but they don't get useful information
sure.
from the actual interrogation.
But that leads to information.
But it does lead to information,
later,
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not defending that, but I do think that the frank and graphic depiction of what goes on in those interrogation scenes, how close they are to reality or not, I think there's still value in that. Because it's troubling, and it should be.
Bull's screenplay is insanely efficient, even though this movie is 2 hours and 30 minutes.
Remarkably so.
The fact that it packages
remarkably
all of
so.
That info into one streamlined.
It fits a decade of intelligence, counterintelligence, and
character development.
Character development
not, on her part.
Yeah, into a 2.5
but
hour movie.
But he's also
it's
very
phenomenal.
Smart in his approach, and that is all of this is focused through the lens of one
of
character.
Maya.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
One character, and I don't think he gets all of the information in as efficiently as he does, unless he makes the very bold decision to focus this story through the lens of one character.
And Bigelow's a big part of that too. I mean, like she shoots with efficiency. I think they're a great pair, and I don't know what they'll explore next or what they'll work with next, but they are definitely a creative team that I'm always going to follow now.
Mm-hmm.
I was with them after Hurt Locker, but after this movie, they've got a kind of permanent place on my on my watch list. My only real complaint is a very small one, and it's with the casting. I would have liked it kind of the way that she chose to cast the Hurt Locker with less recognizable actors. Jeremy Renner wasn't really a household name then, and beyond that, you had cameos at the beginning from Guy Pearce and later on Ralph Fiennes. But for the most part...
But they come in as authority figures.
Authority figures, and
technically
it fits.
James Gandolfini is an authority
but
figure.
But there are several television actors that make appearances here that are recognizable and kind of... It doesn't quite take you out of the movie, but I kind of wish she'd taken sort of a Curtis Hanson approach where you just cast a bunch of no-names and I was about to say and Jessica Chastain... But, you know, that kind of threw me off just the smallest amount. But it's like, hey, there's Mark Duplass. Hey, there's
Chris Pratt.
Yeah, there's John Barrowman from Torchwood. Hey, there's, you know, like, you know.
Joel Edgerton.
There's Joel Edgerton. There's Mark Strong. Like, there are all these little, like, quick guys.
Mark Strong with hair.
Mark Strong with hair and a really, really good, scary American accent. I liked his American accent. It gave me the creeps.
Yeah,
but
part of that efficiency, though, going back to what you were – well, just mentioning Mark Strong, one of the devices that bothered me the first time I saw it was the fact that she kept writing the number of days on Mark Strong's window that they hadn't done anything since they'd gotten the information about where Osama bin Laden was probably hiding. And it bugged me at first. I was like, this is a little on the nose.
Yeah.
And then I realized it was this really nice visual device to ratchet up that tension, because we knew he was gonna, we knew that that's where he was going to end up being, because we know what happened. And now we're just getting more and more excited and worried, and when is this going to happen, and feeling that tension. And that was a great device.
Speaking of tension, and then I want to wrap this up, because, I mean, I could talk about this movie all day.
We're all giving this rock fist way up,
way,
I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Rock fist way up on this. But the other scene, I mean, and the whole movie drives towards it, but the raid. Trey and I saw it in the theater. I mean, it was dead silent, and I was just physically just clenched up, my shoulders, when I walked out of the movie, because it pretty much is the raid and then a couple other things and it's done.
Yeah.
And I felt like I'd been in a straitjacket when I got out of the theater and had to give my comment. Like, it's dead silent. They cut the music. I mean, I haven't been that sort of wrapped with tension in a theater in a long time.
Yeah.
It's so expertly done.
Yeah. Very controlled
and you
largely
know what's
going to
happen. You know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just you know things aren't going to go sideways. You know no one's going to get, you know what's going to happen, and it doesn't. Like, it's such an achievement that even with that information, it was still the most tense I've been in a theater in a long time.
Except when they all got on the plane and then the Jeep came out and started shooting at the plane.
Yeah, and
that really blew it for me.
Yeah, and they had to outrun the.
They had to outrun the terrorists on the tarmac.
Couldn't let it go. Had to throw one more Argo.
I'm sorry, but Argo is just a classic, you know. Yeah, whatever. Zero Dark Thirty just makes Argo look like a piece of crap.
It really does in comparison. So anyway, that's Zero Dark Thirty. Rock fist way up from all of us.
Go see it.
Go see it, please. And now we're going to talk about Gangster Squad, which I might actually be more excited to talk about.
Can I set this one up?
Please do.
Sure.
So this is based on a novel by Paul Liebman, I believe, an LA Times reporter who looked into the Gangster Squad by interviewing Jack O'Mara, who's the character played by Josh Brolin, and Con Keeler, who's the character played by Giovanni Ribisi. And both of these men, and other people obviously associated with it, but both of these men were involved in a squad of LA cops back in the 50s, and actually the Gangster Squad lasted for multiple decades. Let's just say that right off the bat. So
when they say inspired by a true story, they mean they got the names and the time period.
Pretty much that's it. Yeah absolutely.
Which is fine. I don't fault it.
Yeah, I mean, all right.
I fault it for a bunch of other stuff.
I knew from reading the afterword of the novel, which is a nonfiction novel, that there were tons of liberties taken with this film. And I could tell from the previews, they're not always an indication, but in this case, they were an absolute indication of the kind of movie that this was going for, which was, we're going to have all these actors like Ryan Gosling, Josh Brolin, Emma Stone. We're going to dress them up in period costumes. We're going to make the look of a neo-noir or a classic noir in full color, Chinatown, LA Confidential style. But then we're going to absolutely throw all the tenets of what makes those movies interesting out the window.
Yeah.
And we're just going to have a shit ton of gunplay. A storyline that you're supposed to take seriously about honor, and then throw in a love triangle that is frankly ridiculous and never existed, and shoehorn it into all the things that really tame, kind of formulaic, bland Hollywood films do.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this movie did. And once I got over the fact that it was going to be nothing like the book, I really did. I was prepared to enjoy it. I know that Trevin made a comment before we saw the film. Oh, you're ready to hate this. Well, kind of, but I really was trying to enjoy it.
You weren't excited.
No, I wasn't excited. I knew it was going to be a kind of a train wreck, but I, from Ruben Fleischer,
see, that's
who
the
did
thing.
Zombieland, who
did
I
Zombieland.
Loved, yeah. And 30 Minutes or Less, which I thought was pretty good.
Had
it had some great moments.
Had some great moments, for sure.
Yeah,
I expected a lot more than this.
Yeah. So, yeah. Go
well,
ahead,
I thought 30 Minutes or Less was actually kind of a mess. so going into this, I guess I had moderated my expectations. So, you know, going into it, I think that there's some really, and I'm just going to say, like, cheesy decisions within this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really silly transitions and augmented, like, CG camera movements and things like that.
That
just
car
felt,
chase that was so, it, yeah.
It actually felt like, it felt a lot like a serious version of Dick Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind
except
of
except for the fact
it.
That there was no investigation
at
whatsoever.
All. At all.
No.
It was just they always knew who was. There was no mystery.
Yeah, it was just macho showdown one after another.
They chucked even a subversion of the femme fatale.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not even touched on it. It's
she's introduced
straight,
to look like one.
Yeah,
and
it's
then,
just a straight. Yeah. It's a.
Yeah, it's just
a
some.
Total...
We need a girl in the movie to make the formula work.
Yeah.
We put it in the computer and it said we needed to put a actress in it that's hot right now.
Yeah.
So we just got her in there and we're
fine. Well, that's the thing. Is it's really a shameful waste of this cast.
That's what I was about to say. I mean, you've got Josh Brolin, who's done great work with the Coens. You've got Ryan Gosling, who's done great work with Nicholas Winning Refn. You've got...
Oh, and a ton of other people.
And,
I mean, he's just making good choices.
You've got some higher, you know, obviously Sean Penn. You know, like
Emma Stone,
Nick Nolte, which I'm gotta say, I'm a big fan of Nick Nolte's voice these days. Like, holy shit, it's like someone took his voice box out and put a rock tumbler in there. But last week I said it's hard. I don't really give Rock Fist Way Down unless I feel like I'm like being insulted or hated by the director. This is, I'm going to talk about it for a while, but this is a Rock Fist Way Down for me because it is. There is
so many dumb choices.
There's nothing redeeming about this movie at all. Like, the material is beneath every cast member, all right, to start with. Secondly, like, you want to talk about revisionist history movies done poorly? This is, like, the blueprint for that. You look at a movie like Inglourious Basterds, and I know it's not even fair to compare, but it kind of is because, it's a historical revisionist story, and so is Django. But if you look at this... Like, all of the choices are terrible.
Yeah.
And at least those movies, Django and Inglourious Basterds, they play with the genre. They have it's intentional. There's asynchronous music. There's subversion, there's vision, things like that. There is nothing to this movie that makes it stand out and unique or interesting other than the cast, and the cast is just wasted. Nobody has anything to do.
There's one thing that stands out, and that
is ultraviolence.
Ultraviolence sake.
Yeah,
in other words, it's only there as titillation. Yeah. It's only there to make us go, wow, this movie's intense. At the beginning of the film, they rip a guy apart.
Yeah, in half. Guy gets pulled in half by two cars.
Yep.
With terrible CG blood effects. Terrible.
Trey's talking about the CG. That's awesome.
No, it was great.
I mean, but it was noticeable.
It's fair. Yeah, it's noticeable.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is not Verhoeven, like, blood packets all over so it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous, like, CG cleanse.
The plot is insulting and idiotic. I mean,
really quickly, let me go back to the action and the CG for 1 second.
Go for it.
Because here's what I say. As a fan of film noir, neo-noir, crime dramas, and pulp fiction
none of that
style
is in
things. Right.
Your movie.
What I'm trying to say is that I am ready for somebody to reinvent this genre or to take the setting and the characters and put a different genre on top of them. I'm totally fine with that.
Brick?
Yeah. Well, no, but Brick is still a noir.
Yeah, you said
Brick, no,
you
okay.
said move noir to a different setting, the high school,
now
modern
keep
day
it,
high school.
Now do the opposite of what you just said. What I meant was take the
make a
40s
new,
and
make
50s.
A noir western.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, take the setting,
Blade
take
Runner,
the costumes.
Like a sci-fi noir.
No. Okay, you're misunderstanding me.
No, I'm just giving you a hard
time.
No
noir. Nothing noir about it, okay? Just the setting, just the costumes,
okay?
And now we make a different kind of movie. For instance, Bonnie and Clyde, right? Okay. That movie was moving into new territory, right? It was taking something, a period that we associate with one genre, and instead doing something different with it. I'm ready for somebody to not make a noir out of a movie set in the 40s and 50s, a crime drama with mob people and detectives. I'm ready for that stylistic change.
Well, didn't you get that? Because this wasn't a noir. This
no.
This wasn't a noir at all.
Yeah, I got that in this movie, but it was horrible.
Right, so maybe
I'm
just a terrible
somebody,
idea.
No, it's not. I think somebody
can
do it right.
I would say you've already gotten that with Drive.
Well, and that's what I was going to mention, right? But Drive has noir elements in it. And this, and I'm just saying that,
that
it would have been interesting. There's one scene in the film where there's a shootout in the dark And every time somebody shoots their gun, there's a flash of light.
Right.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
was one scene in the
I mean,
film
it was done
where
better
thought,
last year in,
yeah,
in
the
Skyfall.
Freeze frames
it was done better in Skyfall,
go,
but
yeah.
they didn't know if they were doing it at the same time. But
right.
Skyfall did it
and,
better.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is Michael Mann's Public Enemies is not a perfect film. It's a flawed film for sure. It's a little tiresome sometimes. But that is a perfect example of somebody who's taking the period and doing something new with it. He
yeah.
filmed it all digitally. He made it look like it was a fly-on-the-wall kind of cinema verite thing. And that was really interesting. It didn't click. It didn't work 100% of the time, but it didn't suck like this.
No, this – yeah, suck is the optimal word. I mean, it's just all of the action at the end. The,
yeah.
you
oh,
know,
it was
oh
dumb.
Oh, my God.
It was so dumb.
The whole movie is stupid.
Yeah, the choices of who lives and who
stupid.
Dies
– you know, the way that that happens, like I leaned over, we, I, you know, I don't want to, you know, we won't spoil it, but one of the gangster squad dies.
Yeah.
And he, when he dies, I leaned over to Eric and I said, how did they know he was there? There's no way
yeah.
that the people who find him.
The plot doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense. It just kind of, it just kind of moves along and doesn't acknowledge that it's like, there's no reason that that could have happened, whatever. But they, that's like a minor gripe. I mean,
yeah.
Because I kept coming to moments that I thought could have been done. Like, I kept seeing things like, why did he do it this way? There's such a cooler way to do it. Great example. There's a sort of heist-like moment where they go into this club disguised as musicians, and they work their way into the back, and they shut down this whole operation.
But they don't use that at all.
Yeah.
No, but what they cut between this woman who looks like Carmen Miranda and has the fruit hat on stage.
Yeah.
They cut between her and then the action behind the scenes. I thought what a... That could have been done really well if it had been one sustained take, if they'd followed them all the way through the club, behind the scenes, up the stairs, through the security, into the room, sorted out the guys, burned the money, came back down. If they had, like, you pick up actors, you drop actors, there's no cuts. You know, you could cheat and put edits in there somewhere.
Sure.
But I thought that would have been so much more compelling. You know, but there's no playing. There's no one's playing with anything, like, remotely close to that in the movie. There are things like they use really bad CG in a car chase to, like, drop the camera down and spin it around a car while they're chasing.
So weird.
And it's so weird, and it comes out of place, and it just kind of goes away, and you're like, how
yeah.
the hell did that happen? He throws in Matrix-like slow motion at the end for no reason, and
yeah.
it's out of place and stupid. The gunplay at the end feels like kids playing cops and robbers, just how, like, fast and loose they are with the guns. It's like they're playing paintball almost,
yeah.
just throwing bullets and then hiding, and throwing bullets and then hiding, and, like, blind firing behind stuff and killing three people without even trying. It's just such a it's such a lazy movie. And this was the movie that was going to make me decide, you know, this after seeing Zombieland and liking it so much and seeing 30 minutes or less and saying, I don't know, you know, like there's
right.
He definitely didn't seem like he was in as much control as he was in Zombieland. Maybe it's the script. This was the one that was going to kind of make or break him for me as whether or not he actually has the chops.
Sure.
And coming out of this movie, it's a definitive no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I didn't hate this as much as you guys did. I think for me, it's a minor rock fist down. It's a fundamentally flawed thing, fundamentally flawed film. And I don't know that there's any way that I can, with a clear conscience, recommend this film. But I can see how, to some extent, somebody could. I mean, it is a decisively stylistic film. I mean, its use of color and neon and things like that,
yeah,
kind of interesting. Some of the over-the-top costume design and the art direction, that's interesting. And so I think that if the right person went into this, they could have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
They could have a lot of fun with
no,
it.
No argument there.
But I think it's a fundamentally flawed film. And I think that Fleischer makes a lot of really terrible decisions.
I think he was at least trying to spice it up. I think the biggest problem is the screenplay. The
yeah.
number one problem
yeah.
is the awful, horrible, generic screenplay that doesn't make sense from a character or a plot standpoint.
I didn't
mind the Matrix stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you. I was like I said, I'm ready for someone to reinvent it. They didn't do it well in this
Well,
one.
Again, I'm not saying it has to be straightforward, but I'm saying the execution when he did try and get playful or creative was poorly done and not very compelling.
You're trying to do a sort of hard-boiled, like, detective. Like, even if you're trying to do a good guy, hard-boiled, Jesus, I can't get it out. Anyway, I think it's flawed. I think it could have been significantly better.
And also, violence doesn't equal grittiness,
yeah,
all right?
Absolutely.
Ultraviolence does not
totally
equal grittiness, and that drives me insane. Like
John Woo needs to come back and do this kind of a movie.
Yeah, you know, you're not a, he's not a, yeah. I'm sorry,
Face Off and
Face
Broken
Off
Arrow.
Was amazing.
Broken
Face
Arrow.
Off is amazing.
Oh, bullshit.
Oh, yeah. I will defend Face Off to the ends of the earth. That is one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Woo is done also.
It's a good comedy.
It's a great comedy.
You have to view it through the lens of a comedy. It's awesome. A hysterical comedy.
Cage. Travolta.
Malene, you want to throw your definitive stamp on this?
Down.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's it.
That's all you got to say. That's
minor
say.
Dong. Minor down.
Minor
yeah,
dong.
Wait.
Minor dong. Minor down. Jeez.
Mein Vol.
Yeah.
It's a Rock Fist Way Down for me as well. I've already gotten to take it apart, so I won't go any further than that.
Yeah.
But it's really early in 2013, but I think this is going to be the worst movie I've seen for a while. I think it's going to be for a while at least.
Well, next week we have Mama, the horror film, and then the Broken City with Russell Crowe and Mark Wahlberg, directed by the Hughes brothers.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, might
Last
not.
Stand?
That
Last
proclamation
stand
might not
the
last.
Last Stand with Johnny Knoxville and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Ooh.
I think.
Okay.
You might
have
counted your eggs a little early.
I don't know. If the last stand at least has fun with what it's doing and has fun with its genre and has no aspirations to be anything more than
that's
that.
That's true.
Sounds like you're up to bat on Last Stand.
This did have a little Zack Snyder in it.
A little. It had a lot.
And it pissed me off. It's like you cannot be this self-serious and ridiculous at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. So we will be back next week. And in the meantime, have a good one.